Welcome, everyone, to Citizens Climate University tonight. It's on the financial impact of fee and dividend on households and on small businesses. Jerry Hinkle has served as an economist in banking for the last 30 years. He's actually having his last day of work tomorrow, so let's all celebrate with Jerry. Jerry Hinkle of the
Let's party!
And climate policy, and he's been lobbying Congress for climate solutions since 2006. He's served as a regional coordinator for CCL since 2011 and founded the CCL Speakers Bureau and Proactive Outreach Action Team. Both are now essential nationwide programs. Jerry also serves on the board of directors for CCL. We're lucky to have you, Jerry. Thanks for being on the call. After the lesson, hopefully all attendees should be able to have the following. Understand how the household impact study was created and commissioned, as well as its key findings and takeaways. Be able to highlight the main points for your district in preparing for your next meeting, whether that be with a member of Congress or local community leaders. And also be able to prepare specific stories of how small businesses and industries will thrive under a carbon fee and dividends predictable price signal to the market. We're going to do on tonight's agenda is essentially first look at the study's background and key points, and then Jerry is going to review both its methodology as well as results through many of its charts and really kind of walk through any questions that anyone has. We'll then have a chance to really dive into other remaining questions before passing it on to Dr. Harding to discuss carbon fee and dividends impacts with its predictability, investment, and innovation with a thought experiment, and then have further questions. So with that, I'll pass it back to you, Jerry. And
thank you so much for your attention tonight. So what is the study? What are we doing here? Estimates are the impact our policy would have, and it's pretty close to our policy. $15 a ton, all money returned to households, however it is taxable, by zip code. And you can build up from zip code to congressional district. And from there to state and to the country as a whole. It's going to break down the percentage of constituents in each geographic unit that end up ahead. And we'll see some data about how much ahead. And I think it's important. And we'll look at this by different distinctions, wealth, economic quintile, race, age, minority versus white, that kind of thing. So that's what the study does. Why it's important, I think this cannot be understated. Legislation that would have a reasonably dramatic impact on the finances of each household in the country is going to be, people are going to want to know how they're impacted. That's, you know, in most studies, that is the single most important characteristic of policy. How does it impact me? How does it impact my finances? So much of the story looks great. Some of it looks like issues that we will have to deal with. But this study can be very valuable along those lines, because if we don't know, if there's uncertainty, policy likely can't move forward because we're afraid of the unknown, right? And this is an incredibly important area. This study provides some degree of certainty. It's a great first step. Okay, what is the story going to say? First of all, and we'll talk about some of the real positives. Generally speaking, the most vulnerable in society do well under our policy. And it's very important to note here, what's happening is the poor do well, minorities do well. It's not because we have made a conscious effort to redistribute income. That is a bit of a third rail for any conservative. They don't like redistribution. This is not redistribution. What it is in the words of George Shultz, this is the result of simply charging the true cost of products, right? As Alfred Pigou said, you know, if there's an externality created, if there's a social cost, You need to internalize that. You need to charge for that. By doing so and returning all the money to households, turns out that the poor pollute a little bit less, and so they benefit here. Those that, this is a zero-sum game, by and large, right? We're not creating any wealth here. So those disadvantaged, again, probably a good part of the story, are generally those most able to afford it. Income shift stems not from redistribution, but by charging the full cost. And lastly, it's always good to know in analysis like this, there's this huge freebie with climate policy when you look at analysis like that. And that's the tremendous environmental, climate, and health benefits. They're brought out pretty well in the REMI study. They're not brought out here. So it's always good to remember, yes, there's some costs, there are some people disadvantaged, but we all get a much brighter future for ourselves and for the next generation. How do we derive these estimates? What we're looking at is by household. We want to derive the net household benefit, which is the dividend, and you understand that pretty well. Full share for parents or for adults, half share for children up to two. And then the real challenging part is the cost of the footprint. How much is the household's cost going to increase as a result of our policy? And again, we're starting with $15 a ton. That's all we're doing here. And you've got to extrapolate to go to fees beyond that. So you're going to calculate the fee by, first of all, assessing expenditures you're going to break expenditures down into 52 categories of household goods, essentially. That's in the study. It's listed there. We've got them broken into subcategories later on in this presentation. And then you're going to estimate the CO2, the footprint by category. And you're going to aggregate that for the household. The dividend is our dividend. One of the key differences, we're going to tax the dividend. And fossil fuel exports, the fee charged will be returned. It's a fairly minor item. Kevin's study was able to do this for 5.8 million households. That's a 5% sample. That's a lot of information on which to generalize to the country as a whole and by each zip code and then congressional district. Okay, so 52 household items. The information comes from, there's two key surveys, there's others, but the Bureau of Labor Statistics comes out with a consumer expenditure survey. Uses 2008 to 2012, and then there's the American Community Survey, which is done on a periodic basis by the Census Bureau. We then have to estimate greenhouse gas sensitivity. We have to take taxation, the effect on the government, and then the border tax adjustment. So I hope from this you can see how we're generating this estimate of the dividend and then the increased cost to come to a net household benefit. Go ahead and move forward. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of information behind this in the paper, and there's a lot that's not even in the paper. This is key. What's going to drive whether you are benefited or it's a net cost to you? There are key factors. The big one, call it a dominant factor, is income. Okay, we'll talk a little bit more about that. Housing inefficiency. You got a big house with just a couple people, or do you have a smaller home with a lot of people in it? That is housing inefficiency. What we tend to see is suburbs tend to be a little bit more inefficient, larger homes, whereas the urban areas are more efficient on this front. Transportation is going to be similar. Urban areas tend to use more public transportation, have smaller cars, have fewer cars. Suburbs, they have more. So that's key. If you live in a mild climate, you've got less power bills. And low carbon electricity, we'll see an explicit slide on this soon. I live in California. California's got very clean energy. So does much of the East Coast. the Midwest, you know, you can see where the coal-dependent states are. Okay, this is a, I don't want you to make too much out of this graph, but what this is showing you is nationally, it's by zip code, and it's going to give you a general feel for the percentage of households within that area that benefit. And you can see the West, generally cleaner energy, their milder climate, they're going to do better. The Midwest has a harsher climate. Yeah, so you can see the generalization. Clearly, the Midwest does not do well. I remember when Mark first saw this slide, he said, I don't like it. And I completely understand why. But the point that I would underline here is it is with this information that we can forward policy, right? Is the ending policy going to look exactly like ours? Hard to say. But it is with this certainty that we've got a shot at moving forward. I hope that makes sense. If it doesn't, come to me with questions when the time permits. Okay, here's the impact of being able to understand the different carbon intensity of electricity sources across the country. You can see there one key source as to why the Midwest does not do well. It's very coal dependent. And again, the western part of the US is very green energy. Same thing with the East Coast. Go ahead. All right, here's our first key result, and I want to go over it with you in a little bit of detail. This is national results by income quintile. So quintile one is the lowest 20% household income, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So it's got 100% of households. So on average, that's the bar all the way to the left, 53% of households do well. However, it turns out that they have a higher density. And so that 58-59% of households do well. They benefit. The 19% is called, I don't see the title here, but it's, this is households for which there is a net loss, but it is within 0.2% of their income. So this makes, they're about break even is what we're trying to say there. So about 72% of households are break even or do better is the point. And you'll have that on each of these graphs. Okay, so you go to quintile one, important impact. The poorest do well. 86% of households clearly benefit. 2%, it's basically very close to break even. Go down to the first row of data. I think it's important to get our hands around these, especially when you're in talking to your congressperson, you want to show this information. This is the mean benefit. This is the average benefit by household for this quintile. So on average, they come out ahead annually, $280. And this is with a $15 tax. We hope the tax gets to three times that, four times. And you can ratchet it up for the type of tax level that we hope to pursue. And it's important to note, is that 280 important to them? Well, it's almost 2% of their income. So if the tax were three times this, four times this, that would make a real difference for them. Okay. Now, you'll note that the first three quintiles, 1, 2, and 3, they all come out ahead. Danny said recently on a group lead call, others may have heard it at different times, one of our unwritten standards is that we want whatever policy comes out to at least make the bottom two quintiles whole. Our policy does that. Quintile one and two do well. So now let's ask the question, yeah, but where does the money come from? This is pretty close to a zero-sum game. Let's just go to the fifth quintile. You see there, the average household is loose. It's a net cost of $322. And so that pretty closely offsets the quintile one gain. So there is this shift toward the low income from the upper income. But this is important. I think it's important to underline this. The 322, if you look in parentheses, that is only about 0.2% of the income in that quintile. So it's that same amount of money, a little over $300, but it doesn't have much of an impact on their income. Whereas over in quintile one, that same amount of money is 10 times more of their income. And this is one of the benefits of redistribution. It's that the poor, that bit of money is far more important to the poor than it is to the wealthy. So that's a benefit. Again, it's not from an intent to redistribute. It's from an intent to just pay the full cost of the products. This is showing that effect in sort of brilliant terms. So the net benefit to quintile one households is $6.4 billion. The net loss to quintile five is 7.6. You can see two does well, three is close to break even. And so you can see the very important effect of income in terms of who benefits. And we'll look later at exactly what that's from. Go ahead, Brett. More detail on the households. Minorities generally do well. African-American, Latino households, 75% benefit, a significant benefit, $228. And then 11%, really close to breaking. There it is. It's up on my screen. I've forgotten the term, minor loss. So that's a minor loss, less than 0.2% of income. African-Americans do well. Asians, whites, a little bit less than, less than a majority, it's nearly break even. And then 22% are break even. The dollar amount, $52, is not high, but that is where the bottom line to this slide is: the young and the old do well. Okay. 18 to 35, you're just getting going. You're starting to form households, new job. Why? You're not making as much. The elderly do well. They're a little bit less mobile. They're driving less. They're probably using less power, and they have less income. They're on fixed incomes, so they're going to do well. Where does it come from? Look at the 50 to 65. These are people in their prime earning years. And if you will, these are people probably most able to adapt to afford the cost of this. Go ahead. Again, this is sort of sums all of that. Poverty, that's people at the national poverty level or below. Low income, that's two times the national poverty level or below. Minorities taken as a whole, families of four do well. It may be that they the additional dividend income, elderly and single parents all do well. So I put this in terms of those most vulnerable in our society benefit from this. And that's important. But, I don't want to spend too much time with this. Urban does really well. Suburban here has it as well. I thought they were more disadvantaged than that. And then rural does a little bit less well. It's interesting, the policy in British Columbia compensates rural households because of the slight disadvantage. Go ahead, Brett. Okay, I'll spend a little bit of time with this. Here, we've broken down the cost by quintile and by category. And the distinction that I want to draw here is between the bottom two categories, utilities and gas, and the top categories. Utilities and gas are what we call direct energy expenditures. So it's a sort of direct purchase of energy, okay, your power and your transportation or gas. And we see from looking at the all households all the way to the left that it's a little bit less than half. Okay, it's going to rise with income. You can see the light blue and dark blue going up, but not so much. What really goes up is the indirect expenditures. That's the stuff we buy. That's a little bit more discretionary. Why do the income, I should let Rick come on and tell it his way, but why does the upper income have a net cost? It's because they buy more stuff. Generally speaking, it's they have more money, they buy more. So that is the single most important factor in determining who benefits and who does not. And everyone, once you've got, once you have the rules in place, the policy in place, everybody has a chance to reduce their footprint. That's the purpose of this, is to provide a financial incentive. I'm forever in conversation with environmentalists about how do we get people to do the right thing. And with this policy, everyone, every day, is who's on the team to do the right thing, because they all care about their footprint. They all care about their finances, I should say. So this is how you get everyone. But so this is the key. This is what is behind the key factor in who wins and who loses. Go ahead, Brett.
One thing that's just come up timely here, I guess, Jerry, is what is allocated PFI?
Yeah, and I don't know. It's sort of a catch-all, and I don't remember. It may be, I know it's in the paper. I read it a while ago. I think it may be in FAQs, but I'm not sure. It's, I can't answer the question well right now. There you go. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I saw that question and I kind of stuttered. So I've been over this before. Here are the key points that I hope I've made. The most vulnerable do well. Some don't, but it's the folks most able to afford the cost, and we've all got a chance to reduce our footprint and got on the right side of this thing. We can all go EV. Those disadvantaged, generally most able to afford it. We've gone over this. The income shifts stem not from redistribution, and once again, never forget all of the value of this policy. A couple of caveats. This is a static analysis. It's a snapshot at a point in time. It would get far more complicated if you put into it what the likely impacts are of people adapting to the change in relative prices, right? People steadily, slowly moving away to cleaner products, if you will. So this is a snapshot. There's no impact on gross domestic product here, no impact on employment. And worth noting, Kevin is pursuing peer review. It is not yet peer reviewed. By all, this is a much deeper, more granular, more data-intensive look at a question that has been considered for some time. For example, I think this is an important point, and if I don't get this exactly right, pardon me. The Climate Leadership Council, James Baker, George Shultz, came out with their presentation, did a bit of economic analysis, and I believe, someone correct me if I'm wrong, they say 70% of households are benefited under their policy. It's a thank you, Rick, private fixed investment. It's like the increase in cost to buildings. That's what fixed investment is largely, that shuffles through to various businesses and the like. So anyway, the estimates that have come out before Kevin's show a significantly greater number of households doing well. It's interesting. It's somewhat novel. We're an NGO that has commissioned a study that wasn't necessarily favorable. So you go from 70% of households benefiting to only 58%. But it's providing a lot of detailed data that we believe will really assist the policy moving forward when the conversations get serious about this type of policy. So there's two places where you can find this. You can go to the public website and find the study. You can go to, I believe this is community. And so you go to the community household impact study under, okay, carbon fee and dividend, learn, household study impact. And you've got a number of lessons there, the studies and reports. And from there, you can pull off the reports for your individual congressional district. I have used these on occasion.
Box, Jerry, thanks so much for the presentation.
Thank you all for your attention. I really appreciate it.
Also on the call tonight, we have Dr. Phil Harding, who has served as the Linus Pauling Distinguished Engineer and Associate Head of Undergraduate Programs at the Oregon State University School of Chemical Engineering. And Dr. Harding brings a wealth of industrial and business experience to both his teaching and his role as an industrial liaison. So we're really lucky to have Dr. Harding on the call. He's a certified professional engineer, holds 15 patents, and his most recent full-time industrial role was serving as a master technologist for Hewlett-Packard. Thank you for being on the call tonight as well.
It's an honor to be here and talk to you for a few minutes about some of my early perspectives. I'm relatively new to this business. I've been involved for 3 years, and I was pulled into this by a former student who happened to have an economics degree, and he was quite passionate about this type of approach, and he got me involved. And so it's just great to be here. On the left hand side, as a very succinct summary to you all of what was so nicely described to you by Jerry in the past few minutes, is that the UML study is a static analysis. What that means to me as a beginning student of economics, that it does not take into account changes in consumer behaviors. It just assumes that the cost that Jerry articulated is passed directly to consumers, and it computes the initial impact. We know with time that consumers will change their behaviors. When certain activities and certain products become more expensive, they'll change their purchasing and activity decisions. And that's where the REMI study comes in. And that's a dynamic analysis, which is, like Jerry says, correspondingly fraught with assumptions, but it's a great start. And one of the things that the REMI study talks about is these so-called green jobs, which for me seemed so vague, but great to hear, but it really didn't inform me. What does that mean? Where does it come from? Because as an engineer and a numbers person, I was skeptical. Well, how can that be? And as I started thinking about it more and more, I realized that these studies really are a very high level view of the economic impacts of a fee and dividend. And I think that all of us that are so excited about this want to work towards our ability to understand what I think are the thrilling opportunities that surround us every day when we think about the impact of fee and dividend. And so my hope in that learning goal that Brett described is to make people more comfortable coming up with examples to share with MOCs, with their friends, in letters to the editor, and so forth. So it should be obvious to all of us that when someone is deciding where to invest their money, or if a student is deciding what degree to pursue, or a professor is choosing a research area, if a company is deciding where their next product are going to be, they want to go where the opportunities are going to be. But if they don't know where the opportunities are, they're going to make either ill-founded decisions or no decisions at all. Fee and dividend, moving to the second bullet, gives us a predictability. It allows investors and engineers and scientists to say, okay, I know this is coming now, and I have a rough idea, thanks to studies like the UML study, how this will influence product costs and correspondingly consumer behaviors. We've talked a lot about price signals, but that's almost has a disciplinary tone to me. You know, what is it? Price, cost, and the negative. Predictability is a wonderful thing. If I knew there was going to be a forest fire next to my house tomorrow, I would take action. And that would be a good place to spend my money, right? So the result of fee and dividend is that investors can confidently place their bets, and engineers and scientists know where to pursue solutions. They know what to be excited about. They know where to train themselves, where to hire people, and so forth. So let's get to a specific example that I have some familiarity with. So I want to talk about a company that I worked directly with, which called Trillium Fiber Fuels. And if you look at the schematics at the bottom on the right, you see some of my friends, Cassie and Chris. Their notion was that you would develop cellulosic ethanol from grasses that can be grown here in the Willamette Valley of Oregon, to allow those farmers more agricultural flexibility, economic flexibility, and hope in the face of tremendous pressures from China. The team worked very hard developing these processes. They got money. They had projections getting them comfortably to $5 a gallon, which should be very competitive with fossil fuel costs. But what happened over and over again is they would struggle to get money and get investment is, believe it or not, the price of fossil fuels would plummet, right? And I think we all maybe wonder if that's done in an intentional fashion. When you go from $4 a gallon to less than $2 a gallon in a period of months, it often seems to coincide with the number of biofuel companies and alternative energy companies that have started up. What do you know? Well, so that's a tangible example. That company has now gone under. A lot of equipment wasted, a lot of money wasted, a lot of effort wasted. Some of that will translate into their next venture, which is actually making apple brandy with the same equipment. But it's a very tangible example to me of the price of unpredictability on a company's success. So let's go to a little bit more of a thought exercise now, Brett, on the next slide. So again, if you could just focus on the picture there on the upper right-hand corner. This is drawn out of my first experiences in this business with you folks 3 years ago, which was to testify at an Oregon State Senate subcommittee hearing about potential carbon tax and dividend model here in Oregon. And before I spoke, I was preceded by a group from the fruit drying industry here in Oregon. And these gentlemen, in a very concerned and, you know, authentic fashion, said, this will be the death of us. We won't be able to pay for natural gas, and we will pick up and move to Kentucky. And as I sat there listening to them, I thought, if I was an engineer on a manufacturing floor, which I have been for many, many years prior to going back into academia, I would be thrilled. If I was an engineer told that energy costs were going to go up 20% in the next couple of years, I would be on fire coming up with solutions. I would get up off my chair. I would work harder. I would be around the equipment more. And so if that predictability was there in energy costs, I've listed a few of the ideas off the top of my head. You would have increasing efforts in heating efficiency, energy recovery, and insulation. Companies would be popping up all over the place. You'd have competing technologies in burner design. Burners are the devices that inject the natural gas, their efficiency and so forth, and insulation development for new types of insulation. You'd have contractors that would be starting up companies, volunteering to come in and do thermal analyses and document where energy losses are happening. And it would be that would be very exciting. Alternative technologies. On the bottom right, you see a picture of some solar fruit drying technologies that actually are effective in some parts of the country, especially for smaller scale operations where you wouldn't have to worry about fossil fuel based transportation. And then I even write shipping channel innovation. So people that are dealing with logistics and timing in the shipping channel would be very interested in predictable forecasts of these costs. So if you go to the next slide, I now, after doing this for 3 years and thinking about this as an experienced engineer, but beginning economist, forgive me, Jerry, everywhere I look, I get excited. I have a big truck. I actually have a big truck. I also have a Nissan Leaf. And when I see big trucks pull up next to me, I think to myself, fee and dividend. That is going to be reinvent the utility truck industry. Why don't we have EVs that have pickup beds? They're so popular. Well, it's because fossil fuels are so expensive. And look at it all the way around here. Lower left-hand corner, I see a house getting re-roofed, and I see all those asphalt-based shingles just going to the landfill. There's going to be startups interested in recovering that material, removing the nails, recycling it, and creating asphalt shingles locally. On the right is my Nissan Leaf parked in Ridgefield, Washington. And as I sat there and waited for it to charge happily, I thought to myself, wow, it's going to be a lot of fun for people to think about a 20 to 30 minute charge time, how that changes consumer behaviors, and where I should put these charging stations, and on and on and on. And I'm hoping that as I share these examples with you, that all of you start to look around you and don't just report about having a million new jobs, but can give people tangible examples that are, I think, really exciting. They localize farming, localize manufacturing, and really give people hope for the positive attributes of a fee and dividend model. And so I encourage you, and this is a rhetorical exercise for you, is to identify a carbon-intensive object or activity and ask yourself, what are the economic and technology opportunities that will come out of that when a fee and dividend is in place? And I think practicing that is good for each of us, because when we sit in front of an MOC or an MOC's aide, we'll be able to give her or him tangible examples with which they can work. These examples, I think, are going to be very important as we try to make our case going forward. And so far, so good. But the more arguments we have, the better. And so with that, I'll hand it over for questions. And if I went too quick, please feel free to ask me questions. Thank you.
Bravo, Phil. Thank you so much. And we are honored to have your insight. And we wish you a wonderful rest of your week ahead. Thank you for joining us tonight on CCU. Thanks, everyone.